I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Ben Markowitz's new book, The Rest of Our Lives, was released in the UK earlier this year and was shortlisted for the 2025 Booker Prize. It was just released here in the United States. The novel follows a man who drops off his daughter at college and then decides to keep driving, taking a road trip to sort out his feelings about an affair his wife had a decade or so earlier. I recently spoke with Ben Markowitz about the road trip and some of the real-life connections he shares with his main character. Here's our conversation. So The Rest of Our Lives was one of the finalists for this year's Booker Prize. And in a video released by the Booker Prizes, I saw you describe the novel in both 6 and 7 words. I'm going to give you a few more than that, but could you give our listeners a description of The Rest of Our Lives?
Yeah, so it's about what happens to a marriage after the kids leave home. And the specific premise is that it's about a guy whose wife had an affair when the kids were small. And he gets through a bad time by telling himself that when the youngest goes to university, he can rethink his life and walk out of the marriage if he needs to. And the novel opens when he drops his youngest daughter off at university.
So let's talk a little bit about that relationship. It's Tom and Amy. And as you said, we learned early on that Amy had an affair a decade or so ago. How does that affect where they stand now, or does it?
I think it does affect it. I mean, there were problems in the marriage before she had the affair. But one of the problems subsequent to the affair is that it puts her in a position where she's always the person who did wrong, and he's always the person who's in the right. And that's a really intolerable recipe for any kind of relationship, least of all a marriage. But it also means that there's this conversation which they had many years ago that they have not really had in a while. And she knows it's coming, and he doesn't really want to talk about it, because he's not quite sure what to do yet. And that's kind of the pressure building at the beginning of the novel.
As the title suggests, Tom is grappling with what the rest of his life will look like as he takes, you didn't really mention, a road trip through his past. He visits a brother, an ex-girlfriend. He goes to see a son. He kind of doesn't really know where he's going or where he'll end up. But did you know where you were going as you wrote this? Did you know where he was going?
Yeah, I had a sense that he was going to end up in California. It was going to be bookended by the kids, because the son doesn't get much of a look in at the first third of the novel. It's mostly about his relationship with his daughter. And his son is in grad school in LA, and eventually he's going to end up there. It seemed like a fitting kind of bookend, given that he starts off in New York, that he should finish in California. I mean, one of the problems with the road trip novel is that it often involves your character driving away from the source of the plot. And the plot in this case is the marriage, but he's driving away from it. So one of the challenges of writing the book was to keep, you know, the source present in different ways.
Talk to me about basketball. Tom is especially interested in basketball, and I read that you have a connection to the sport.
Yeah, so my first job coming out of college was I played for a second division basketball team in Germany. I don't know if it's more glamorous or it was less glamorous than it sounds, and it doesn't sound that glamorous. The only kind of exciting part about it was that I happened to play in the same league as a young Dirk Nowitzki. I don't know if you're a basketball fan, but a few years after I played against him, he won the NBA Finals.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it was one of the subplots in the book is that while Tom is driving across America, he doesn't really want to explain what he's doing because he doesn't know what it is. And he comes up with a kind of cover story, which is that he'd always had this idea when he was in grad school, before he went to law school, that he might be a writer. And one of the things he could write about is playing pickup basketball and driving across America. And so he starts telling people that this is what he's doing. And he actually gets into a few pickup basketball games, but his heart really isn't in it, because his heart is in the problem that he has not been facing, which is the problem in his marriage.
I also read where you commented on a seemingly mysterious illness you experienced, just like Tom. This is a work of fiction, but I'm curious about how much of your own lived experience went into its crafting.
Yeah, a lot of it. I mean, when I started the novel, I had these symptoms that my doctor couldn't diagnose. And before I knew what they were, I gave them to Tom because they seemed part of the general picture of what happens to you in middle age. Your you know, various things are going wrong, and one of them is your body has started to betray you in ways that you can't understand anymore. And by the end of the novel, I knew I had lymphoma, and I finished the first draft while I was going through chemo. And that really changed and shaped what I wanted the book to say, because your view of the world changes when you get sick. Part of what happens is that you see how many people are nice to you. And I've described it before that at the beginning of the book, Tom feels like he's been pushed from the center of his life. And in a funny way, when you get sick, you feel very much at the center of a lot of attention. And that changed how I wanted to think about the book. I did actually go on a road trip, a bit like Tom's, except I did it with my wife and kids. And I was getting sick and I didn't know what I had while this was going on, but it was still, maybe partly for that reason, one of the most cinematic and vivid holidays we ever took as a family. Partly just because the landscape is so incredible. I mean, the book is also about what it's like to drive across America. And in our case, we started in Austin, where I grew up, and ended up in California, where I was actually born. And it's just such an amazing country to look at out the window of the car. And that played a big role in the story, too.
Perhaps this is because of my own reading tastes and, of course, my own demographics. But I've read recently, you know, quite a bit about women in this middle age to older middle age stage. As an author and also as a reader, do you feel like the male equivalent of this time in life might be lacking in literature?
That's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I want to say that men aren't good at complaining about their predicament. That doesn't seem very likely. I wonder if there may be more similarities. I'm just trying this thought out between what men and women go through, but because they get dressed up in different ways, we don't see how much in common they have. I call the book The Rest of Our Lives, not The Rest of His Life, partly because what's at stake is their marriage, and they're both going through something. And what they're going through is that you shape your life around your kids to some extent when you have them, but then the kids stop needing you in the same way. And you've got to figure out some other shape for your life. And I think that's something that they do have in common. And part of the point of the book is to get them to see that.
I think it's fascinating that this feels like a distinctly American novel, but it was originally published in the UK, where you are currently located. And first of all, how much time is there in between the publishing of the book in the UK and in the US?
I think it's going to be about 8 months, something like that. It came out, I think, at the end of March, and it's coming out in England, and it's coming out at the end of December in America.
How does it feel now that readers in the U.S. are finally experiencing this road trip across the country?
I mean, it means a lot to me. I hope you can hear from my accent that I am an American. I did actually become a British subject about 15 years ago, and I've lived in England about half my life now, but my formative experiences were mostly American, and the people I'm most comfortable writing about are American. So it's very important to me that there's an American audience for this book, which feels like a very American book. It would seem strange, you know, that wouldn't be part of its core audience.
During my research, whenever I would type your name into a search engine, your Wikipedia page would be one of the top results. And after your name were the letters FRSL. You are a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Is this a lifetime honor? I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I guess so I got an email, I think, asking me if I wanted to join this, you know, very old and established institution. The really exciting part of it for me is that you sign, when on your induction day, you sign your name in the fellows book, and you get to pick one of three pens. And I picked one of Lord Byron's old pens, and I've written some novels about Byron. And so that was a thrill. But, you know, like, England's an old country, and it's good at doing these sort of ceremonial things. And it was nice to be a part of it.
I was going to ask you which pen you chose. Can you talk to me a little bit about, you know, being a finalist for the Booker Prize?
Yeah, I mean, I felt very lucky. You know, you can't control these things. You can't work towards them. You try to write books that you like, and you hope there's an audience for them. It was a lot of fun while it lasted. And one of the things I hadn't realized, I kind of thought of the Booker Prize as a prize that attracted a certain amount of attention. I hadn't realized what a big organization it was, full of very nice, smart people who are good at talking about your book to a large public. And so I've been very grateful for everything they've been able to do little videos and question and answers and events that attract a different kind of attention than you can normally get as a literary novelist.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
That's a really interesting question. And actually, one of the things that the Booker Prize makes you do is think a little bit about what you're in this for. And I guess that I hope for all, each of my books that somebody out there will have the kind of relationship with this book that I have had to a handful of novels that have really meant something to me. In this case, the specific thing I guess I would want to leave a reader with is some sense that even though it's a novel about a guy walking out on his wife and thinking or hoping he can start again, that it's also a book about reconciliation. He spends a lot of time on the road thinking about Amy and what went wrong in their marriage and what part he might have played in it. So that it's not really a novel about a guy walking out. It's a novel about a guy trying to figure some things out. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, the book is The Rest of Our Lives. Ben Markowitz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz was published by Summit Books. Up next, book critic Suzanne Perez says 2026 is shaping up to be a great year for book lovers.
There's been a lot of talk, including right here in this review space, that 2025 was a year without a quote-unquote big book. Now, don't get me wrong, there was plenty to read, and I had a tough time culling my annual list of favorites down to a manageable dozen or so. But the publishing industry as a whole went without an indisputable widespread hit, like Percival Everett's James or Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11. For example, this year's Kirkus Prize, Booker Prize, and National Book Award went to three vastly different novels. Lucas Schaefer's The Slip, David Soloy's Flesh, and Robbie Alemadine's The True True Story of Rajah the Gullible. But let's not wallow in the past. 2026 is shaping up to be a banger of a year for book lovers, with several big-name authors returning after long breaks. The new year promises plenty of literary fiction, short stories, and brain-busting nonfiction. So let's take a look at the nowhere-near-complete lineup. Late January will bring us George Saunders' second novel, Vigil, which takes place at the bedside of an oil company executive in the twilight hours of his life. Lincoln in the Bardo vibes, anyone? We'll also get political nonfiction from Heather Ann Thompson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Blood in the Water. Thompson's new title, Fear and Fury, will look at the 1984 shooting of four black teenagers on a New York City subway train by Bernie Goetz, who later became a vigilante hero to millions. In February, look for another short story collection from Lauren Groff, her first since Florida in 2018. We'll also get a new novel from Tayari Jones, author of An American Marriage, which won the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2019. Spring and summer will bring new novels from heavy hitters Ann Patchett, Jane Smiley, and Maggie O'Farrell, as well as Cool Machine by Colson Whitehead, which will wrap up his Harlem trilogy that started with Harlem Shuffle. In April, investigative journalist Patrick Radden Keefe returns with London Falling, A Mysterious Death in a Gilded City and a Family's Search for Truth. Fans of Empire of Pain and Say Nothing will no doubt clamor for this true-life tale that opens with an apparent suicide and then delves into London's criminal underworld. Upcoming short story collections include ones from Louise Erdrich, Rachel Kong, and Ruth Ozeki, and a book of essays from two-time National Book Award winner Jesmyne Ward. We'll get celebrity memoirs from Liza Minnelli, Laverne Cox, and Octavia Spencer, and another book from perennial humorist and personal favorite David Sedaris. As if that wasn't already an embarrassment of riches, 2026 will also bring new novels from Emily St. John Mandel, Minjin Lee, Dave Eggers, Emma Straub, Andrew Sean Greer, and Elizabeth Strout. And we're already getting word of some buzzy debut novels, including Caro Claire Burke's Yesteryear, which is set for an April release. This satirical thriller tells the story of a modern-day social media influencer who wakes up one morning in 1855, and is forced to grapple with the harsh realities of a real tradwife lifestyle. Wow, that's a lot to look forward to in the coming year, So plug in the reading lamp, rev up the library card, and let's get ready to read. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
You can find a list of these 2026 releases at kmuw.org. And now we are joined by Steve Iwanski, owner of Charter Books in Newport, Rhode Island. We've invited Steve to talk about new releases, forthcoming titles, or books he just can't stop thinking about. Welcome to Marginalia.
Hi, Beth. Thank you for having me.
So what is on the top of your stack, Steve?
Well, there's one that I've been just telling everybody about this fall. It's my favorite debut that came out this year. It's called Trip by Amy Berrodale. It's really weird. It's heartfelt. It's hilarious. The plot is basically there's a documentary filmmaker for a public broadcasting outlet, and she travels to Nepal to report on a spiritual conference on the afterlife. And one morning she slips coming out of her shower and dies. And her soul enters the Bardo, where she can observe her other spiritual conference attendees, you know, bickering about salad dressing and engaging in like gossip and all this meaningless stuff. So she can't communicate with the living, and she's struggling to help her son Trip, who's a teenager on the autism spectrum, and he's run away from the group home that he's in, and he hitched a ride with this like venal, vain, middle-aged loser who steals a yacht, and then they go straight into a hurricane. So that's the setup. safe to say I've never read anything like it. Neither will you. But I found it like it's zany combination of like the cosmically sublime with the absurdly mundane. Reminds me a lot of Patrick DeWitt, George Saunders. But it's a debut, and she's bringing something entirely new to the table. It's hilarious without being gimmicky, and the mother-son relationship in it is really deeply felt, and it packs a punch.
That sounds like a lot of fun, but also deep.
Yeah, it is. You know, like the comic and the cosmic. It's a hard trick to pull off, but a good writer can do it. She is one.
Very cool.
Another one that I expect I'll be handing to a lot of people is called Proto by Laura Spinney. I think this is going to be our runaway best-selling history this year. It's the story of a reconstructed language called Proto-Indo-European. It's the common ancestor of, you know, dozens of languages across Europe and Southwest Asia, including English. But it was spoken by Neolithic people about 6,000 years ago, so there's no written record of it. It predates writing. But linguists have been able to reconstruct it by tracing all these other language roots all the way up the tree. So, you know, it's been written about before. This is not a new idea. You know, they had this idea in the 19th century. But what makes it thrilling to read about in 2025 is that technology is now allowing linguists to team up with geneticists, archaeologists, anthropologists, geologists to illuminate more of the prehistoric past than they ever have been before. So this is one of those books that has like a mind-blowing fact on every page where you're just like elbowing people next to you to tell them. Like there are these early villages that spoke Proto-Indo-European around the Black Sea. They were creating beautiful, ornate, intricate gold jewelry that they were trading with people on foot thousands of miles into like Kazakhstan. And we know they were doing it on foot because humans hadn't invented the wheel yet. So like there's all these like, you know, it's so far back that there's all these amazing facts that you find on every page. And I think it's perfect for anybody who loves like Jared Diamond, Guns, Germs, and Steel, David Graeber, Yuval Harari. But this book is shorter and punchier and a lot more current than any of those bestsellers. So that's what we've been handing to a lot of folks looking for kind of big history books.
I was wondering how it was going to be this thrilling book from a subject 6,000 years old, but you've sold me on it.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, just kind of tracing these things all the way back. And of course, it's so deep in the past that we'll never find out if any of this is true. But, you know, using genetics and DNA and stuff, they can kind of have a good idea. So it's great. Staying with nonfiction, I think the buzzy current affairs book of the fall is going to be Enshittification by Cory Doctorow, which is getting a lot of press, but you know, this isn't really a hidden gem. It's sort of out there, but this is one where like people keep lending each other copies so that everybody can read it. So if you don't know about it, it's he's a tech writer and he's trying to diagnose the appalling awfulness of the internet, these days and hopefully prescribe a solution. So, you know, you think about Facebook, Twitter, iPhones, Adobe, Microsoft, Uber. These are all things that were once kind of wonderful features of the 21st century, and they've declined. He calls it inshittification. But he lays out the stages really simply. Step one, the platform is great for users. Step two, they screw over their users to make it great for business customers. Step three, they screw over the business customers and claw back all the value for themselves. And then step four is, and this is right from his book, they become a giant pile of so, you know, once you read the first few pages of this book, you kind of see it happening all around you, anything that's kind of in the tech world. And you realize that it doesn't have to be this way. We can stop it. So his solutions kind of tend more toward like bigger levers than the average person can pull. But at least, you know, readers are aware of the problems and that they, you know, we don't have to accept them. And then I want to talk about a book that's in paperback now that actually came out last year, which was my favorite debut last year. It's called Only Here, Only Now by Tom Newlands, who's a, it's a debut. It's a Scottish writer. It's just, there's this, it's this teenage girl. It's the 90s. She has undiagnosed ADHD and she's the narrator, and her voice and her sense of humor are just unforgettable. It's one of those books where you can tell from the first page that you're just going to love this character because the internal monologue is so unforgettable. So I've been telling people it's like Dairy Girls done by Dave Eggers, sort of that kind of mix of coming of age and kind of a kind of forgotten industrial area in the UK. But it's original, it's unabashedly Scottish, it's poignant, and it made me laugh to the point of tears. But you know, this is one of those books where I just wanted to read everybody these great sentences from it that were, you know, just unforgettable. So I can't wait to see what he comes up with next. But that's recently out in paperback.
Very cool.
Another one that we've loved is The Rabbit Club by Christopher Yates. This is just a feast of a book for people who love literary thrillers like The Secret History. It's very much in that dark academia world, but he's a huge fan of Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov, which is a very playful kind of Hall of Mirrors sort of book. So it starts as kind of dark academia, Cambridge in the 90s and, you know, secret societies, but he's doing a lot more from the outside as the author to kind of deceive and add these illusions and sort of trapdoors. So it's got a lot more going on than kind of the typical sort of like college thriller. So that's The Rabbit Club by Christopher Yates. And the last one I wanted to mention is, you know, here in Newport, and I'm sure the rest of the country, you know, we're getting ready for the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So there's a lot of revolution books coming out. But the one that's risen to the top for us is We the People by Jill Lepore. Back in 2018, she had a book called These Truths, which, you know, was a massive survey of U.S. history. So like that one, this book sort of, it bills itself as a history of the U.S. Constitution. But what she does really well is it's actually a Trojan horse for a much more radical idea, which is that she's demonstrating relentlessly that the Constitution was compelled by the people of the 1780s to be even more amendable than the framers intended it to be. And that the genius of it is its amendability, not any divine revelation carved in stone. So she lays out the evidence that our country has improved the most when it's passing amendments in bunches, but it gets stultified and cracks when there's too much time between amendments being passed, which is a period we're in right now. So it's a big doorstopper of a book, but yet it's, you can't put it down. You know, she's laying out a lot of stories that didn't get told in other history books to kind of show that like it's this grassroots pressure that has kind of lurched America forward through amendments. And so that's, you know, that's what we're looking for right now. So that's We the People by Jill Lepore. She's, I'm sure you know her work, but she's a professor at Harvard, staff writer at The New Yorker, podcast host, mother of three boys. So I have no idea how she had time for this, but it's essential reading. So we're glad she did.
What is your favorite book ever so far? Like if you had to tell somebody to read one book, I should have given you a heads up that this was coming as well. Sorry.
Okay.
You're the first person I've actually asked.
Oh, good. So the Bible isn't taken? No, it's okay. Wow. Yeah, I get asked that a lot. But since I'm the first and I'm not going to try and be too cool or anything, I'm just going to give my honest answer. And that is, and I've been saying this for 20 years, I annoy everybody with this, but I really think it is Moby Dick. And I think every American needs to read it. It, you know, people who have never read it like to say, well, what could there possibly be in there for me? It's a bunch of, you know, greasy whalemen in the 1840s on a ship. But everything about America is in it. You know, he prophesied everything and he put in there all of the craziness that has erupted at every period in American history. I mean, you've got this demagogue leading this, you know, at the time, very diverse group of sailors on this crazed mission. And we see that, you know, we see these characters come up again and again in American history, you know, an Ahab and a Stubb and a Starbuck. And I think it's all in there. And for people who are intimidated by its length or its denseness, I often open up a copy and show them that it's like 200 something chapters. The chapters are like 3 pages long. So I tell people, like, read a chapter a day. I mean, you really can get through it a chapter a day. The chapters are like, they fly by. So if you can commit to that, you'll get through it in a few months. And yeah, I could go on and on, but I think that's rightfully there with the great American novels, because he somehow put it all in there. Yeah, I get into like arguments at the pub with people about Moby Dick, and usually the people that dislike it the most never actually have read it. You know, it's like one of those books where, like, if you actually go through and read it, you become a convert instantly. So I was going to ask you, you know, this year, I went through a lot of your episodes and over the past few days and listened to it, but what have you loved the most that you've, you know, off the record that you can
off the record
say
this
without...
year? Well, it can be on the record. Did you see any on my list that you liked?
Yeah, I loved the Ian McEwan was great. Back through now, because of course we're reading 6 months in advance.
I
read them so long ago that now that they're out. Someone on our staff loved The White Hot. I saw you just talk to her. I didn't read that, but we have a bookseller who liked that. So we're already. I told our staff the other day that we've got to be looking at like May and after.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to figure out what the summer books are going to be. There's one I thought about mentioning here, but it's so far in the distance that it's called John of John by Douglas Stewart, who wrote Shuggie Bain and
Yungo.
It's so good. I'm reading it right now. It's
amazing. Okay.
It's, his new one, I think it comes out in May. So I hope you get to talk to him, because that's going to be, it's a bomb of a book, but it's going to be great.
You have given us a lot of books to think about. This segment has been edited for time. You can listen to our entire conversation and find a list of Steve's book recommendations from this episode of Marginalia at kmuw.org. Steve Iwanski of Charter Books in Newport, Rhode Island, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you for having me.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Luann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.